Welcome back to Introduction to International Relations. This is the first optional lecture for this module. That means that there won't be any test questions drawn directly from this material, nor will any of the activities be based on it. However, you may find future lectures considerably more difficult to understand if you skip this one. I know it's a little on the long side, but I strongly encourage you to keep listening. As you can see on the first slide, there are four goals for this lecture. First, I'm going to go over some basic terms and concepts. Second, I'm going to talk about how scholars attempt to quantify, that is, put numbers to, abstract concepts such as power and democracy that have no obvious or natural unit of measurement. Then I'll discuss expected value, which ends up playing a really important role in future lectures. And finally, I'll briefly review some basic rules of arithmetic and algebra, explain the role algebra will serve in this module, and give you a quick example. If you turn to the second slide, you'll see two important terms. The first is variable. Variables are alphabetic characters, such as A, B, and C, Greek letters, alpha, beta, gamma, and sometimes even words that are short for a string of numerical values that differ across observations. Observations, incidentally, are the basic units of a data set. They are the things that we're trying to analyze. So, for example, if I were to ask all of you how tall you are, which of course I have, then each and every one of you who responds will form a separate observation. Variables are sometimes confused with constants. As the name implies, however, the latter do not vary. Across observations, their numerical value remains constant. They are sometimes represented the same way, though, and that's why people can get confused. For example, in most data sets, gender is a variable. Suppose I collected data on students at an all-girls school, however. Since everyone we'd have information on would be female, setting aside the distinction between gender identity and biological sex, gender would be a constant within that particular data set, even though it's a variable in most others. Turn now to the third slide. There, you'll see an example of a data set, which may help those of you who are visual learners. The very first row tells us the names of the variables or constants. Each row after that contains unique observation. Note that while there are 21 rows in the spreadsheet, there are only 20 observations in the data set. To help clarify that, I've included a variable that simply records the observation number. That's in the first column, and I've named it obs for short. If you're not familiar with spreadsheets and tables, rows run across, columns go up and down. Obs is not a variable we do anything with in terms of analysis, but sometimes it's useful to have identifying variables in our data sets. In the second column, we have k. How do we know k is a constant? Well, because it doesn't vary. In all 20 of the observations, k takes on the same numerical value. It doesn't matter that the particular numerical value k takes on is 1, even if it was 17.4983 or whatever, k would be a constant. What matters is that it doesn't vary across observations, which, as I said in the very first lecture, means we can't use it to explain anything that does. In the next three columns, you see proper variables. I've named two of them x, the first x1 and the second x2, cleverly enough, and the last one y. As I discuss in the lecture on statistical analysis, x is commonly used for independent variables, and y for dependent variables. More on what those are later. For now, just note that variables are sometimes named for what they measure and sometimes for the role they serve. The actual values of these variables are irrelevant. I generated them randomly. I'll show you other spreadsheets in the future where the variables will actually measure things we care about. For now, I just wanted you to see what a dataset looks like so that the definitions I gave on the previous slide might make a little more sense. On the fourth slide, you'll find two definitions related to probability. The first just tells you what probability means in general. It's a measure of how likely something is to occur. There are other ways of expressing the same idea, such as with odds or ratios, but probabilities are what you'll see most in this and other modules. They're typically written, as it says on the slide, as P parentheses X, where P is short for the probability of, and X is an outcome of interest. For example, P parentheses rain might mean the probability that it will rain tomorrow. If there's a 33% chance of that happening, the probability would be 0.33. If the probability of something happening is zero, then it is literally impossible. If the probability is 1, then it is absolutely inevitable and is certain to occur. Note that when more than one outcome is possible, either it will rain or it won't, you will either enjoy the next movie you see a great deal, find it all right, or you'll hate it, the probabilities associated with the specific outcomes must sum to 1. That sounds like a tricky little rule that anyone might forget, but all it means is that something has to happen, even if that something looks like nothing at all because things just keep going as they were. In other words, when I tell you that the probability of it raining tomorrow is 0.33, I've implicitly told you that there's a 0.67 probability that it won't rain. Keep this in mind moving forward, because sometimes I will tell you the probability of something occurring, and you'll need to be able to figure out the probability of it not occurring. And the answer to that will simply be 1 minus the probability that I gave you initially, at least if there are only 2 outcomes possible, which is pretty much all you'll ever see in this module, because I've tried to keep things simple as best I can. The second term is conditional probability. This is just a particular type of probability, namely one that applies when we have some additional information to go on. Suppose, for example, that I'm about to pick a card from a standard deck. The probability of it being a club is 0.25, as the 4 suits are equally represented. Now imagine instead that I'm in the middle of a game, and I know that more than a quarter of the cards that have already been dealt were clubs. Now, the conditional probability of the one I'm about to draw being a club is less than 0.25. My estimate of the probability that I'm about to draw a club has to take into account the fact that I have some information on how many are left. So that's it for terminology. Let's talk a little bit about how scholars of international relations come up with numerical values for abstract concepts like power so that we have variables to work with in our datasets. There are 3 levels at which a variable can be measured. In order of precision, we have nominal, ordinal, and interval or ratio. Those last two are actually slightly different, as I'll discuss in a little bit, but they're similar enough to be lumped together for now. A variable that is measured nominally is one that assigns different numerical values to the different possibilities, but those numbers have no real meaning at all, because there is no sense in which a 1 is less than a 2. So if we're analyzing people's votes in an election, we need a way of representing their choices in our spreadsheet. And we might put 1s in the cells of voters who backed Labour, 2s for the Tories, 3s for Lib Dem, 4s for UKIP, etc. We could easily swap all those numbers around, though, making UKIP 1, Labour 2, Conservative 3, and Lib Dem 4, and nothing would change, the numbers aren't used to distinguish how much of some characteristic a given observation exhibits. They're just there to separate categories. Yes, you could try to place the parties on a single left-right dimension, in which case you could say that a 1 is less conservative than a 2, which would in turn be less conservative than 3, in which case you'd no longer have an ordinal measure, but sometimes we're not comfortable doing that. Suppose instead we'd ask people their favorite flavor of ice cream. Whatever numbers you assign to vanilla, chocolate, and so on will be entirely arbitrary. Larger numbers wouldn't represent more of anything at all. We'd simply be slotting people into different categories. Ordinal measures, in contrast, do take amounts into account. Crudely, though. Here, a 1 is definitely less than a 2, which is less than a 3, but we can't really say by how much. Suppose we conducted a survey and asked people whether they agreed with a statement such as, membership in the EU does more harm than good to people like me, or the like. Following standards in the field of polling, we wouldn't force people to simply agree or disagree. We'd offer an option for those who are not sure, and we'd probably try to get a sense of how strongly they felt about it, too. So we might offer a 5-point scale, allowing people to strongly disagree somewhat, neither agree nor agree somewhat, or agree strongly. The individual responses, taken all together, would give us an ordinal variable. With interval variables, the differences between the categories are even more meaningful. Not only is a 1 less than a 2, but by the exact same amount as a 2 is less than a 3. If we can go even further and say that 4 is literally twice as large as 2, then we've got a ratio level measure on our hands. The classic example of the difference between interval and ratio is Celsius versus Kelvin. The difference between 20 degrees Celsius and 30 degrees Celsius is precisely the same as between 30 and 40, but 40 is not twice as hot as 20, because 0 is sort of arbitrary. Yes, it has more meaning than in Fahrenheit, which stupid Americans like myself favor for unknown reasons, but it doesn't have the same meaning as 0 Kelvins. We're not going to concern ourselves with the difference between interval and ratio variables much in this module, however. What I really want you to keep in mind is that we don't need a perfect, beautiful, glorious ratio measure for analysis to be possible or meaningful. Though, of course, we do have to be more careful about the conclusions we draw when we're dealing with variables that are measured more crudely. Some of the variables you'll see in this module will be nominal. Did these two countries fight a war against each other in that year or didn't they? Some will be ordinal. Does this pair of countries stand to gain a lot from trade or relatively less? And some will be either interval or ratio. What percent of the military capabilities that might be brought to bear in a war between these two does the weaker side control? You might be thinking to yourself that it's silly to even pretend we can measure power the way we can measure height. And I'd have to agree with you. The thing is, no one's pretending to have done that. We can work with variables at lower levels of measurement, as long as we're careful not to overinterpret the results. That's the most important point about measurement. But let me just say a little bit more about how the sorts of variables you'll be seeing throughout the module are constructed before moving on. As it says on the slide, some variables incorporate more than one component. Height only measures one thing, how tall you are. Sometimes, however, we come up with a single number by averaging across other measures or performing a preliminary set of statistical analysis that generates predicted values for a variable we wish to use in our main analysis. For example, if you're trying to test the hypothesis that Euroscepticism accounts for how people voted in the 2016 EU referendum in the UK, you could use a single variable, such as whether they voted UKIP in a previous election. You'll see in the lecture on statistical analysis, shockingly enough, that there is a strong relationship there. But you might also try to construct an index of Euroscepticism that takes into account whether people have voted UKIP in previous elections, whether they agree with statements such as the one I used earlier to talk about ordinal measures, whether they own a visa, and so on. Scholars sometimes try to take a bunch of variables that all seem to be tapping into a common dimension and convert them into a single measure like that, because it allows for simpler analysis and a cleaner presentation of results. Similarly, we might think that expectations about the future shape current behavior. Governments who are afraid of coup attempts might behave differently than those that are not, for example. We could put a bunch of variables into our analysis that would account for differences in the probability of a coup, or we could just come up with actual estimates ourselves and only have to include a single variable. There are downsides to that, to be sure, which we don't need to get into here, but you should be aware that some of the variables you'll see in this module won't be direct, concrete measures of anything, but will instead be my attempt to take lots of information into account without having to show you ugly tables of results with loads of variables included in them. On the fifth slide, I discuss two important examples of concepts we think matter a lot in international relations, and so would like to include in our analyses, yet which can't be measured perfectly. The first is power. Conceptually, that's often defined as the ability to get others to do what you want them to do when they otherwise wouldn't. That's a nice, succinct definition that matches most people's intuitions about what the word means. The problem is, I can't just say the US has 7 units of power, the UK 5, and Sri Lanka 1. If I did, people would rightly ask where those numbers came from, and why I didn't assign the UK a 6, or a 4 for that matter. Some people even take issue with the claim that the US is the most powerful country in the world, though that remains the conventional view. What we can do is measure factors that are observable and likely to enhance a state's ability to get others to do what they want. That's imperfect because we don't know for sure that these things have that effect or how well they translate into an ability to alter others' behavior, but at least we can all agree that the numbers are probably pretty accurate. There are various ways of doing that. The slide mentions 3, though all the analyses you'll see throughout the module are based on the first one, partly because I came up with it and I think it's a pretty good measure, thank you very much, but also because it's easier for students if things don't change much from lecture to lecture. The M scores I put together reflect how much money a country spends on the military relative to prevailing standards of the time, and the number of military personnel, again, relative to prevailing standards. The exact calculation is a bit involved and not worth getting into, but just keep in mind that they range from 0, no military capabilities at all, to 1, the largest, most well-funded military anyone could feasibly have produced at that time. In other modules, you might hear about sync scores, which come from the Composite Index of National Material Capabilities. Those are based not only on military spending and personnel, but population size, energy consumption, and iron and steel production. In the interest of full disclosure, my M scores are constructed using the base components of the SINC scores. I think they paint a picture of where different countries stand and how that's changed over time that better matches most people's interpretation of history, but they wouldn't be possible if others hadn't put in the hard work that gave us the SINC scores. I don't want anyone thinking my contribution here is greater than it is. I also mentioned GDP on the slide, that's gross domestic product for anyone who isn't aware, because some scholars argue that wealth matters more than military might. In some respects, I'm sure they're right. When we evaluate claims about the causes of war, however, I think it's appropriate to focus on military capabilities. Since we'll be spending a lot of time doing that later in the module, and not so much ranking countries for the sake of ranking them, You won't see me use GDP as a measure of power. But that's not to say it's unimportant, just that I'm trying to keep things simple for you, and so we'll use the same variable in every set of analysis. Similarly, there are various ways of measuring how democratic a country is. We all have some sense of what that means conceptually, but there's no consensus on how important differences in the electoral process are, such as differences in turnout rates, compared to differences in outcomes, how often does power change hands, are the needs of the disadvantaged being met, etc. Surprisingly enough, these debates can get quite heated by academic standards. I'm not interested in taking a side in those debates. I just want to say that we've got a variety of imperfect measures that one can certainly criticize, but are still reasonable enough that we can use them to look for overall patterns. In other modules, you might hear more about the differences between polity scores, the VDEM, varieties of democracy scores, and binary measures that other scholars have put together. I'm not going to get into that here. None of the analyses you'll see in subsequent lectures would have come to substantively different conclusions if I'd used alternative measures of democracy. I'm quite confident of that because the patterns I've identified have showed up in dozens and dozens of studies, many of which did use alternative measures. If you'd like to hear more about them, though, feel free to ask after class or email me. On the seventh slide, you'll find a graph of the M-scores for the principal victors of World War II for the period 1946 to 2007, the last year for which I have data currently available. I'm not going to spend much time talking about this graph, but you might want to hit pause here and examine it for a bit so you can convince yourself that the M-scores, while imperfect, tell a pretty believable story about demobilization after World War II, the superpower rivalry of the Cold War, the collapse of the Soviet Union, and so on. On the eighth slide, I discuss expected value. Like I said earlier, this is going to prove useful later on. I'll explain how in the lecture on game theory. For now, let's just tough our way through the technicalities. It's really not as bad as it looks anyway. Suppose we've got a random variable x. A random variable is one whose value is determined partly by chance. That isn't necessarily true of all variables. There are n different things that can occur, and each does so with its own probability. I use subscripts here because there may be more than one probability we need to keep track of, depending on how big n is. Each outcome also has its own numerical value. I know this is abstract, but I'll give a concrete example soon. So the expected value of x, written as capital E with x in parentheses, is equal to the sum of pi times zi, or zi. That funny looking symbol that kind of reminds you of an E, it's actually an uppercase sigma for those of you who know your Greek letters, is the summation sign. It tells us to perform the same operation again and again, starting from the first possibility and ending with the last, then adding everything up when we're done. In this case, that means multiplying probabilities by the values associated with different outcomes n different times and adding up all the products. Nerds like me write it that way because it saves space, but if you find that intimidating or confusing, you can write it the long way. E of x then would be p1 times z1 plus p2 times z2 and so on until you get to pn times zn. Still too abstract? Okay, turn to the next slide where I'll give you a practical example. You and a friend place a wager on the outcome of an election, as it says on the slide. Your friend agrees to pay £20 if the candidate or party that you bet on wins, because polling indicates that they're a bit of a long shot. If your friend is right, and the candidate or party who's currently ahead in the polls does in fact win, your friend only asks that you pay them £10. The pollsters and prediction sites are saying that the long shot, whom you've backed, has a 35% chance to win, which certainly does make them an underdog, but hardly means that they're out of the running. That means that the probability of you winning the bet is 0.35, which necessarily means that the probability of you losing the bet is 0.65. Remember, probabilities must sum to 1. So what is your expected value for this wager? Well, as it says on the slide, that would be 50 pence. Why is that? Because that's what's left after we apply the formula from the previous slide. Here, n equals 2, because there are two possible outcomes, either you win the bet or you lose the bet. Z1 is 20, Z2 is negative 10, P1 is 0.35, and P2 is 0.65. Multiply the P's by the Z's, add it all up, and you get 0.5, or half a pound, also known as 50 pence. On the 10th through 12th slides, you'll find a few basic properties of arithmetic and algebra that are worth revisiting, as well as some warnings about common mistakes. Because this is all pretty straightforward, and should be a review of things you've learned in the past, I'm not going to talk you through these slides in great detail. If anyone feels uncomfortable even after listening to this lecture, though, get in touch and I'll provide additional assistance. The commutative, associative, and distributive properties tell us that it doesn't matter what order we write things in, as long as we don't change the operations being performed. Nor does it matter what order we perform operations of the same kind. Finally, when we multiply one thing by a group of others within a set of parentheses, each of the terms inside gets multiplied by the one outside. When it comes to fractions, I found that many students forget that we can't cancel common terms in the top and bottom the way we can the left and right hand side of an equation or inequality. That is, as I say on the slide, 1 plus 2 divided by 3 plus 2 is not the same as 1 divided by 3. The former is equal to 3/5, while the latter is 1/3. If you add an arbitrary constant to both the numerator and denominator of a fraction, in other words, you push it closer to 1. That's something you'll see again later in the module if you pay close attention. Students also sometimes forget that we can't break additive or subtractive bonds in the denominator, though we can the numerator. That is, A over B plus C is not the same as A over B plus A over C. If it was, then 1 over 2 plus 3, or 1/5, would equal 1/2 plus 1/3, which is approximately 0.833. Factoring and expansion are two sides of the same coin, and they follow immediately from the distributive property. We can pull common terms out of two or more expressions that are linked by addition or subtraction, or we can do the reverse and break up parentheses by multiplying things through. When you see two sets of parentheses, which we've implicitly got if we square one set of parentheses, remember to FOIL, which means first, outer, inner, last. The next slide reminds you of the various ways we can manipulate equations and inequalities. You can add or subtract a fixed quantity from both sides, because it's every bit as true that 2 is less than 3 as it is that 1 is less than 2. Or you can multiply or divide both sides by the same quantity, because it's every bit as true that 4 is less than 8 as it is that 2 is less than 4. We can't, however, multiply or divide both sides by 0. That's an important exception. We can add or subtract 0 to both sides, of course, but not multiply or divide by it. We can multiply or divide by negative numbers, but if we're dealing with an inequality, we have to remember to flip the sign. 5 is less than 7, but negative 5 is greater than negative 7. Finally, if you want to rewrite an inequality so that the right-hand side is now on the left, you again have to remember to flip the sign of the inequality. 3 plus 4 is greater than 6, and 6 is less than 3 plus 4. I suspect all of that felt pretty familiar to you. If you have any questions about anything I just went over, though, feel free to ask. I'd be happy to help clarify things. Before wrapping up, let me just say a few words about how algebra is going to be used in this module, and then give you an example. You're probably used to being asked to solve for x and coming up with an actual number at the end. That's got its uses, but that's not what we'll be doing here. The mathematical models you'll see in this module will generally have more than one unknown, and we're not going to be looking for the answer that solves the equation or inequality. We're using variables instead of concrete numbers because we want to build generalizable theories of international relations. And so any number we substituted in for the more general expressions would apply to only one very precise situation. That's just not very useful. We want to talk about when states are more likely to behave one way versus another, not find the one way they all behave all of the time, because no such thing exists. The maths would be easier with hard numbers, and you'd all be very happy about that, but the models would be useless. I will often solve inequalities for a single expression, using the same rules you learned in the past, but I'm not looking for an actual number. Instead, I'll be creating a cut point. As it says on the slide, a cut point is a critical value or threshold above which something different happens than does below. Because that's fairly abstract, and most of you probably can't picture what that looks like or why it would be useful, I've got a simple example on the next slide. This example is going to look awful familiar when you get to the lecture on game theory. Suppose you've got the inequality you see there on the last slide. S greater than or equal to P times H plus 1 minus P times L, where L is less than S, which is less than H, all of which are strictly positive. Note that P is a probability. I chose this particular setup for a reason, but that won't be clear until later. For now, just go with it. So we've got this inequality that's just one term on the left, but a compound expression on the right, and we want to solve for P, which won't give us a concrete answer in the form of a numerical value, but will allow us to establish a cut point. Again, this will make more sense after the game theory lecture. For now, I just want to show you how we use algebra to establish cut points, leaving the why for later. First, we get rid of the parentheses. That gives us S greater than or equal to PH plus L minus PL. Then we subtract L from both sides, so everything with a P attached to it is alone. That gives us S minus L greater than or equal to PH minus PL. Then we factor the P out on the right-hand side, giving us S minus L greater than or equal to P times, in parentheses, H minus L. Next, we divide both sides by the stuff in parentheses, leaving P all by itself. That gives us S minus L over H minus L greater than or equal to P. Finally, we rotate that, giving us P less than or equal to the same fraction. That fraction now becomes our cut point, and we can replace it with a new term. That is, we can now say that the inequality holds if and only if, that's what IFF means, by the way, that's not a typo, P is less than or equal to p hat, where p hat is equivalent to the fraction from above by definition. Three horizontal lines, incidentally, is a little different than two. Two means that we're tentatively saying the two sides are the same, but we may have to check to see if that's true or find the values of x for which it is. The symbol with three lines, which looks like an equal sign drawn by someone who's had a little too much to drink, means that one side is being created right then and there for the sole purpose of being a shorthand version of the other side. We're not saying that it's possible that they might be the same, requiring some poor student to prove as much, but defining a new piece of notation. And we do that just so that we don't have to write as much at some point in the future. Because if there's one thing maths are good for, it's facilitating laziness. That's how we use algebra to establish cut points. And that's the main thing we'll use it for in this module. I will do most of that behind the scenes, in fact. You won't have to do any algebra yourselves. I just want you to have some sense of what I'm doing and why. As I've said a few times now, that will be clearer after the game theory lecture, but hopefully this lecture has prepared you to get the most out of both that lecture and the one on statistical analysis.